Hello and welcome to the Scottish House of News podcast with Jimmy Black and me, Kieran Finlay. In May 2020, the Scottish Government's 2014 Unsuitable Accommodation Order was extended to all homeless households, effectively ending stays in unsuitable accommodation for any homeless person for more than 7 days. At least that was the idea. Since then, these laws have been consistently broken by the majority of Scotland's local authorities, with violations now increasing at an alarming rate.
Now, according to some reports, specifically the Herald, councils are ready to confess that they have failed to carry out their legal duties in as many as 11,000 cases of homelessness in the last 18 months alone. So today we're asking whether the unsuitable accommodation order is fit for purpose, if the rules are being properly enforced, or, as is often the case, the issue lies with a lack of resources.
To help us clarify the legislation around homelessness and to share the practical problems of finding suitable accommodation, I'm glad to say we're joined by Councillor Jane Marr, the Housing, Homelessness and Fair Work Convener at the City of Edinburgh Council, and Sophie Berry, a solicitor at Govan Law Centre. Jane, thanks for coming onto the podcast. When someone presents as homeless at the Edinburgh Council, what are councils legally required to do at that point?
Well, if somebody presents homeless to us or any council, then by law we must offer a minimum of advice, assistance and temporary accommodation to all homeless households and those at risk of homelessness. So for example, we must assess the levels of homelessness in our area and provide information and advice about homelessness free of charge. But that's fundamentally what drives us legally. But, you know, if I can just say, Kieran, It's not just about the law, it's about what's fair and just for people, for the citizens of our city. And to me, it's an absolute disgrace that in a wealthy city, we've got the levels of homelessness and people in temporary accommodation that we do have. So the law is the framework, but what really drives it is a sense of social justice.
Sophie, can you tell us, from your point of view, a bit more detail about the obligations that councils have to house homeless people when they arrive at the door?
Yes, so essentially when someone presents to the homeless team initially, the council's obligation is to carry out inquiries into their situation to determine whether or not they are homeless or threatened with homelessness. And in the meantime, their duty is then to provide them with interim accommodation until they've established whether or not they are homeless or threatened with homelessness.
Now, in terms of what does homelessness mean, that seems to be something which has been fought over in the courts for decades, ever since the Homeless Persons Act was passed. What does homelessness actually mean? Does it mean that you're on the streets, Sophie?
No, not necessarily at all. It just means that you're staying in an accommodation that's not suitable. And that depends, obviously, on the needs of the household. And often it's people who are not on the streets. They are sofa surfing or staying in unsafe or unsuitable accommodation.
I was just going to chip in to what Sophie said and totally agree. I mean, we're lucky in Edinburgh that we have very few people actually sleeping rough. And the majority of people who are homeless actually might have a roof over their heads, but it's not a temporary, I mean, it's not a permanent roof over their heads, with all sorts of consequences. For example, for children, in terms of continuity of their schooling, for example, together with any community support that people who are homeless might benefit from. So I think as well, just to reiterate what Sophie said, in a sense, the statistics are the tip of the iceberg, because there are folk, you've pointed out, Sophie, who are sofa surfing, staying in, you know, cramped accommodation with relatives, all sorts of situations that we don't know anything about.
Are people who are in hospital stuck because they're no longer able to use their own accommodation through disability? Let's say they're on the top of a tenement and they can't go home. Are they homeless?
Yes.
I think we're both nodding here. Absolutely.
And who else could be homeless? Someone who is of domestic violence, for example.
Absolutely. So my role at Govan Law Centre is I work at the Women's Project. So we deal almost exclusively with women who are escaping domestic violence. So often they will be sofa surfing or they'll be staying in an unsafe relationship and it's not suitable accommodation. So they are homeless.
Yeah.
And just before we leave the kind of legal framework, there are standards of suitable temporary accommodation. Sophie, could you take us through some of those?
Yes, so there are the basic standards for suitable temporary accommodation, which are that there are three levels of standards for accommodation. Basically, there are the basic standards and then location standards, and all accommodation must meet the basic standards. So that's that they're wind and watertight and that they meet minimum safety standards now, and also that they're suitable for a homeless family to live in. And then there's location standards that they're within access of, for example, schools and health and support networks, places of employment. And then there are physical standards such as access to bedrooms, toilet, a living room, washing facilities, those kind of things. There are exceptions to those, and especially in terms of the physical standards and the location standards, if there's no accommodation available, then the local authority can house someone in accommodation that doesn't meet those standards for up to 7 days.
Sophie, there was a recent ruling in the Inner House of the Court of Session which overturned a previous decision that judge councils had the absolute duty to provide appropriate housing even if it was only temporary. The case in question related to a family with an autistic child who the family had argued that the number of bedrooms they were provided with was not adequate. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the new decision was that while not ideal, it was reasonable for Glasgow City Council to house the family in a four-bedroom home on an interim basis instead of the five-bedroom home that was deemed adequate. I know Govan Law Centre was involved in this case. Given what we've spoken about today in terms of temporary accommodation standards and what is adequate, could this case have a wide impact?
Yes, I think it did briefly before it was appealed that, you know, when the position was that the local authority had an absolute duty to find temporary accommodation that met the needs of the household. And the position currently following the appeal is that essentially the local authority has more discretion to determine what is suitable, what does meet the needs of the household as a whole, rather than having to specifically meet the disability needs, for example, of each member of the household. So it's more of they have to take into account the needs of the household as a whole rather than the specific needs of each individual. That makes a huge difference to people in temporary accommodation, because people can be in temporary accommodation for a really long time, months or years they can be in temporary accommodation. So if it doesn't meet the specific needs of an individual member of the household for their disability needs, for example, then that can have a serious impact on a family.
Jane, could you outline the challenge that is facing Edinburgh Council at this moment in time in terms of the numbers of homelessness applications, the increase in those, And what steps the council's taking to meet those challenges?
Well, when I came into this convenorship just over a year ago, I was absolutely horrified when I learned about the homelessness statistics in this city. And they haven't changed significantly since I came into this post for various reasons, which we can touch on. But tonight in Edinburgh, a wealthy city, we've got around about 4,700 households in temporary accommodation. And when I talk to people, the public, about that, they're horrified and shocked, largely because I think folk equate homelessness with rough sleeping, which of course isn't an accurate picture of the real extent of homelessness. So that equates to around about 7,000 people. And of those, there's no point pretending that everybody is in suitable accommodation, because we know perfectly well that they're not. I mean, they meet the basic requirements that Sophie's outlined, but they certainly don't meet the other criteria that most of us would accept as being normal requirements for any kind of household. So the fundamental problem here, and I will come back to what we're doing about it, because we're doing lots about it, Kieran, in a minute. But the fundamental problem in Edinburgh is the lack of social rented homes. So we've got so many people in temporary accommodation, largely because the alternative would be the streets, because there's nowhere for us to be able to house people permanently, which clearly is the most desired solution. If you look at the picture of our housing situation in Edinburgh, we've got the highest private rents in Scotland. We've got only, now don't quote me on the exact stats here, but something like 14% of social housing in the city, compared with the Scottish average of 23%. So we've got escalating rents, we've got a diminished public rented sector, and that means that there's simply almost literally nowhere for people to go. If you add to that the fact that paradoxically, Edinburgh is a successful and growing city. So we've got round about 250 new people coming into the city every month, all of whom are looking for somewhere to live. So the demand outstrips supply, and there are obvious consequences for particularly rents in the private sector. I mean, there are lots of other factors, such as price of land, such as competition with developers who are looking at, for example, developing student accommodation, and we just can't outbid them when we're looking at available land. And of course, land is another limitation in the city. You know, we're very limited in what land we can acquire and what land we own. So it's the old cliche, a perfect storm.
What steps are Edinburgh taking to meet some of those challenges? You can take one at a time. You could take the rents, and then you could take the number of social homes.
So, I mean, we agree with the Scottish Government that the best way to deal with homelessness is to prevent it happening in the first place. And I think we've been very successful through our rapid rehousing transition plan. So we've got, we've funded on a permanent basis, 44 new posts to support the strategic priorities of that plan. So it's basically, in spite of its rather fancy title, it's saying what can councils do to prevent homelessness. We've got income maximisation officers who try to make sure that, for example, tenants and others who present as homeless are getting all the benefits that they're entitled to. We've got transformation team who supported, I think last year, I'm just looking at my stats here, around about 550 households to move from temporary accommodation to settled accommodation, because that transition can be quite challenging for some people. And we know from experience that often folk flounder when they get into a tenancy of their own. So all the support that we can put in place to make sure there isn't a kind of revolving door of homelessness where folk take on a tenancy that they can't sustain and then re-present as homeless. We're working in close collaboration with the private rented sector. So the team there have supported people in the private rented sector to remain in their tenancy, because that's what we always want. Particularly, actually, Sophie, I'm thinking about, you know, domestic abuse, because often it's the victims who have to or encouraged to move, when in fact it's better for the household to be able to stay where they are.
I want to come to Sophie, but before I do, just to put the task in a national context, there are 39,006 homelessness applications in a year, or they were last year anyway. There are 30,000 roughly open cases on any one night, and that was the figure for the 31st of March. There are 15,000 households in temporary accommodation, again as of 31st of March. Given that level of pressure on the housing stock, what is the point in taking legal action against the council?
What is the point? Well, I suppose the point is the individuals who come to us when we take legal action against the council, there usually tends to be a good outcome. But you're right in that there aren't enough houses, so there isn't a good outcome for everybody. And that's just the situation that we're in. I suppose the point of taking legal action is to try and force the councils to do something about their breaches of statutory duty, which seem to be largely accepted, that there's just be a certain number of breaches. And I suppose the more judicial reviews we raise, we hope that that would put pressure on the system to change.
When these cases are brought to you and you can take them to the council, how often do they reach court? Are you seeking damages and immediate change in circumstances? What's the kind of most likely outcome?
And we're usually seeking immediate change in circumstances more than anything, mm-hmm. because we're usually dealing with emergency cases where clients are homeless, so they need a quick result. We often do raise judicial review proceedings, or even if we indicate that we're going to raise judicial review proceedings, then that usually ends up in a resolution or a settlement, which is usually that the local authority will agree to house the person or to reconsider the decision that they've made that we think is they're in breach of their duties.
Sophie, we understand that, you know, you're probably not working in Edinburgh very much because you're the Govan Law Centre, but there's a number of other local authorities that you will be working with and are working, almost working against in the case of authorities that you're taking to court. Is it all just, I mean, is it okay for the councils to say, well, we're doing our best, look at the numbers that we're facing? Or are there things that councils are doing wrong that you're picking up that, you know, actually need to be highlighted?
I think both. I do think that there are not enough houses, so the local authority can't meet their duty, and that's just acknowledged. It's just kind of accepted. But there are also things that could be done differently. And I'm not convinced that the statistics on homelessness are reflective of the actual issue, because there are a lot of people not presenting as homeless. Mm. So the numbers are much larger, I would say, than even is reported. And even with the reported numbers, it's acknowledged that there aren't enough houses, and so there aren't solutions for everybody.
The discussion we were having earlier about what is a homeless person, how is it defined? I think you could probably apply a number of the same descriptions to people who are on the housing waiting list, who are not actually applying as homeless, but are simply looking for a transfer within the council stock or within a housing association stock locally. Isn't there a dual system here whereby you have to be quite savvy to work out which way is the quickest way to get a house?
Absolutely, that does seem to be the case. And also, I think a lot of the time clients are discouraged potentially from presenting as homeless because they're afraid of the stigma of being homeless, and they're afraid that they may be placed somewhere that they don't want to be. And sometimes they're discouraged from making homeless applications and encouraged instead to put themselves on the housing register or to apply to local housing associations and wait and stay in unsuitable accommodation in the meantime.
48% of lets go to homeless people. Now that means that 52% of lets don't go to homeless people. How can that be justified? And I think this is a question for both Sophie and for Jane. How can it be justified that homelessness seems to be the most urgent state of housing need that you can be in, and yet 52% of the houses don't come to you? So, you know, what's going on there? Explain.
I suppose in any local authority or any situation, you've got to prioritise, and we prioritise those in greatest need. And in fact, we allocate 70% of our available housing stock to people who are homeless, because it makes sense in very straitened and tight financial circumstances to prioritise. And I think that's fundamentally the issue.
I don't really think it can be justified, really. I think that obviously the homeless, I mean, that would be our position, is that the homeless family should be the priority.
Talking about these cases that Sophie and the Govan Law Centre have taken to court and tried to find immediate change in circumstances, and to your knowledge, Jane, has Edinburgh been involved in such cases? What have the outcomes been like, and has the council changed anything as a result?
I know Shelter have taken us to court. What's changed as a result? Well, One of the things that is going to help us resolve the problem, and I'm going back to your original question about what we're doing about it, Kieran, is that effectively to build more social rented homes. And we are doing that. So, for example, in March this year, we agreed £173 million spending package to upgrade and build new homes. And since 2012-13, with the Affordable Housing Supply Programme, we've already completed 1,000 homes with 940 social rent and 80 mid-market rent. And we've got 188 new homes scheduled to be completed this financial year by the Council House Building Team. And in fact, we just had one of our busiest months for site start since before COVID. So we've done groundworks for over 118 affordable homes, the majority of which are for social rent.
In terms of the supply of housing, in 2007, there were 607,000 social rented houses in Scotland. There's been a building programme since then. The Scottish Government make great play of the number of houses they've financed and built. And as of today, there are 608,000 socially rented houses. We might have improved the quality of social rented houses, but we haven't increased the number. Why not, is the question. Why haven't we managed? And it's not fair just to pinpoint Edinburgh, and Edinburgh has specific problems with land supply, the cost of land, and all the things that you've described. Why haven't we been able to move the agenda forward and increase the supply of housing so that we actually have what we need?
The way I see it is, in order to build, you clearly have to have money to do it. Where does the money come from? And this presumably applies to all local authorities. And it comes effectively from council rents and from government grants. So we have effectively a limited amount of resource to be able to build what we need. In Edinburgh, as in common with other authorities, we produce a strategic housing investment plan which sets out what we need to actually fulfill the requirements in the city. And the gap between what we need and what we get from the Scottish Government is just over £400 million. So that shows you the scale of the problem. And in a sense, all the activities that I've described in terms of house building, they're a drop in the ocean. Let's be frank about it. They're nowhere near fulfilling the need that we have. Then the other source of funding is the rental income that we get. And out of that rental income, we have to pay for any new builds. We have to pay for refurbishing to the Scottish Government's very laudable high EASH2, so environmental standards, to retrofit to those standards. That costs money, and it's all coming out of council rents. I mean, hold the front pages. There's a cost of living crisis going on. So do we put up council rents to a point that would take us back onto our house building programme that was outlined in our strategic housing investment plan and take the consequent, well, we don't take the risk, the tenants then take the risk of our council rents being unaffordable because people are pinched on so many. I mean, I don't need to tell you, I don't need to tell Sophie, you'll have people all the time in dire straits because of the cost of living crisis.
And actually, I was going to come to Sophie and say, what's the human cost of high rents? What's the human cost of not having enough houses to go around? And what kind of stories do you see in the law centre, the kind of people that you're helping?
The clients that we see every day are either struggling to pay rent or are homeless or at risk of homelessness or staying in unsuitable accommodation, staying in damp, disrepair, or are unable to make their mortgage payments and are facing eviction, facing repossession for that reason. That's the cost, I suppose. And when there's no affordable housing, when there's no social housing, then there's limited private residential tenancies. Obviously, that puts the price of private tenancies up and just exacerbates the situation for everyone involved.
And how successful is the Law Centre in finding solutions for people?
Fortunately, we usually have good outcomes in most cases, but some cases it's really quite varied, I suppose. In terms of mortgage evictions, it's very difficult because the costs have gone up so much that people are just not able to afford to keep their own homes. Rent arrears cases, again, it really varies. A lot of the time, people are just unable to meet the arrears, that no matter what they do, they're not going to bring in enough money to make payments towards the arrears, never mind meet the current rent payments because the rents are going up so much.
And I think it's only fair to touch on the work, your day-to-day work on the domestic abuse side. Tell us about the specific problems in that area in terms of needing an immediate outcome, in some case within minutes or hours, never mind days and weeks.
It's such a complicated area. I think this is why the Women's Project was set up, because it's women facing homelessness in these circumstances have such different experience to anyone else facing homelessness, I think. And you're usually faced with a client who, as you were saying, Jane, there are several different outcomes that people might be looking for. They might be looking to stay in the house and exclude the perpetrator, or they might be looking to move away from the area because they're afraid of that the person knows where they live, or they might be traumatised by their experience of staying in a property in which they've been subjected to domestic abuse. A lot of the women we meet also are caring for young children or disabled family members, and so that affects their decisions when they're presenting as homeless. And I think it's a particularly difficult area when they're approaching the counselling and they know they have certain duties, but their priorities might not always align with what their legal rights are. So the council has a duty to provide them with a suitable temporary accommodation, and they may meet the needs, those obligations in terms of the law, but the individual may have completely different set of priorities. So then you're dealing with trying to make decisions about whether the homeless route is the appropriate route, and if it is the appropriate route, does the local authority, and I do think different local authorities handle these cases very differently, will they be able to provide accommodation that meets their needs in terms of the local support network in the area they want to be? They may want to stay in the area that they're in because they have a support network there and the children go to the local schools and they have maybe employment in the area. Yeah. Or they may want to escape the area altogether because they're afraid of potential risk of violence to themselves or the children. And so it's about meeting the individual needs of that person, I think, and it's important to make sure that they're aware of what their rights are in terms of what they can expect to be offered in terms of temporary accommodation or permanent accommodation or refuge accommodation. So those are the challenges that we deal with every day, and I do find that the local authorities have quite varied responses to these situations, I think.
Sophie, sorry, do you mind if I ask Sophie something? So do you find then that the fear of inferior alternative accommodation encourages, and it's mainly women, to stay in abusive relationships because the alternatives are so unsavoury?
Absolutely, I do. And I feel like sometimes they present for help and then they're dissuaded from leaving an abusive relationship because they're told, well, you may be put in an area of the city you don't want to be in, or you know they might be afraid that they'll lose their children if they bring up that they might be deemed to not be keeping their children safe. So there's lots of barriers for women who are experiencing domestic abuse in escaping that relationship, and it is making the decisions as well whether to leave, whether to try and stay.
So Jane, harrowing stories there, and clearly there is good work being done by some local authorities. What's Edinburgh doing in this area of domestic abuse?
Well, it is challenging, and Sophie's pointed out some of the human challenges and the importance of treating individuals as such. We, in May 2020, introduced domestic abuse housing policy. And I think the important thing about that was that it wasn't just something that was produced by the council, but it was a multi-agency document where, for example, there were common agreements about consistent approaches across all the different agencies, and a consistent approach, agreements about confidentiality, about support, the importance of support, we're back to that, the importance of prevention, including staff from all the different agencies being trained in risk assessment in the sense of noticing when domestic abuse might be taking place. So that's all linked to the prevention part of the strategy. And then, of course, a whole lot of options in relation to moving home. And Sophie's outlined the main ones, and it clearly depends on the needs and wishes of the people involved. So we also have a domestic abuse housing management group, which meets, I think, once every 3 or possibly 6 months, can't remember exactly, to keep oversight of all of that. So we do have special arrangements in place to recognise the complexities and try to deal with the consequences of domestic abuse.
Sophie, you're not a politician, so it's not fair to ask you political questions, but what do you wish could happen? I mean, what do you think is actually required to actually tackle the problem of homelessness and the problems of poverty that you're seeing in the Law Centre? What does the Scottish Government need to do?
I think, I mean, as you said, I'm not a politician, so I don't really have the answers, but I do think that it's going to be impossible without more investment in affordable homes. And that affects people who are homeless, people who are renting, people who are in social housing, are all affected by the lack of affordable homes. And that just can't be achieved without more investment.
Given the level of demand, given the fact that it seems impossible for councils to actually deal correctly with all the homeless people who come to them, does that devalue the law? Would it actually be better just to accept that these standards are unattainable and we could relax the standards so it's easier for councils to meet them? Does that make any sense to either of you?
Not. I'm sure Sophie will say no. Do you want to speak,
no.
Sophie?
I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. I think the standards that are in place are very welcome, and it's just about making sure that the resources are there to make sure that the standards can be met. I think they're in a lot of cases, the bare minimum that should really be expected.
I totally agree with you, Sophie. I mean, if we didn't have high standards, then we would have nothing to, well, I was going to say to aim for. That's not quite what I mean. But to hold, because it's the governments who set the standards, we'd have nothing to hold them to account for. So if they're saying to us, you must, for example, house people in suitable temporary accommodation, great. Where's the money? We don't have it. Edinburgh's the most underfunded per capita in the whole of Scotland. And that takes me back to a point that we referred to before, and I was interested to note that Sophie talked about funding. I've yet to meet any serious organisation, including all of the shelter and all of the voluntary organisations who have anything to do with housing and homelessness, and the registered social landlords. I've yet to meet anybody who doesn't say, Scottish Government, put your money where your mouth is. Fine if you want us to meet all these standards, but it cannot be done within the dwindling resources that local authorities have.
Thanks, Jane. And with that rallying call, we'll leave it there. My thanks to Jane Marr from the City of Edinburgh Council, to Sophie Berry from the Govan Law Centre, to Jimmy Black, co-host. We'll be back in a couple of weeks.